I was digging through some. Well, I was pulling up the rundown for us, and in my Tino folder, I realized I had a spreadsheet called Tino Bets, and there's one bet in it. That's it. It's between it's between Ben and Mao, and it's between Jose Valverde and Kyle Farnsworth.
Episode 71 of There Is No Offseason Baseball Prospectus podcast focusing solely on Fantasy Keeper and Dynasty League formats. I am your host, Ben Carsley of BP Boston and the BP Fantasy team, and I am joined by BP's managing editor, Brett Sayer, and BP's minor league editor, Craig Goldstein. Welcome back, guys. We're doing a great job of keeping on track. And on a scale from 1 to Nomar Mazara, how hot do you feel right now, Craig?
I'm the full Nomar.
Full Nomar.
Yeah,
that's frightening.
It is. Wow. It's swampy down here. It's gone straight to summer. I don't like it.
And Brett, I know you tend to be more reserved in your temperature fluctuations, but how warm are you?
I am not quite a Mazara. Maybe more of a Profar.
More of a Profar. Yeah, that's fair. I think I align closer to you this time of year. Okay, so we have an exciting episode of Tino scheduled for you in this one because we are going to speak to Jim Callis a little bit later, and he actually knows things about baseball and minor leaguers. So aside from Brett's soliloquies, this will be a nice change of pace for our listeners who will actually learn a thing or two in this episode. We promise it won't become a regular thing. But we do like to treat you guys every once in a while. So Jim Callis is going to be on to speak about the draft and give you guys some information about some particularly pertinent fantasy prospects there within. And then we'll be back after the draft to do a more routine Tino-esque drafting of post-draft players because we are nothing if we are not all about meta-commentary. But before we get to Jim... and if you want to fast forward, now is a good time to do so. But before we get to Jim, we are going to do a little spin-off of a game that we heard on Effectively Wild, I think 2, maybe 3 weeks ago now, in which we bring you guys a group of 3 players, we discuss them, and then we sort of break down who we are most or least confident in. I know that concept's a little bit nebulous to start, but I think you'll get the gist as we go along. Craig, do you want to do a better job of explaining exactly what it is we're going to be experimenting with?
Yeah, so it's just a group of 3 players. We'll talk about kind of where each of them are at, whether we're, you know, which one we're most confident in, whether it's a return or just sustaining what their production is going forward, that type of thing. And then at the end of that, each of us will essentially assign out of 100 shares each. We'll say kind of how confident we are in each one by putting a number out of 100 on each guy. So should work pretty well.
That makes sense. And do we want to just establish sort of base rules for these numbers right now? So 20-team Dynasty League, that's the format we're thinking, right?
Yeah, I like that.
Okay, cool. All right, so we're going to break this up pretty evenly. We're going to start with 3 hitters who are not doing so well, and then we're going to go to 2 sets of pitchers who are not doing well, 3 young pitchers, 3 not old pitchers, but pitchers who are slightly more advanced in their careers, and then we're going to finish it up with 3 outfielders who are having terrific seasons and let you know how we feel about them. But we're going to start off with the trio from a team that honestly doesn't really ever get its due. And I feel like we've never talked about these guys before at all on Tino, especially back in the Mao days. And we're going to talk about 3 Cubs. And we're going to talk about Javier Baez, Jorge Soler, and Addison Russell. Obviously, all guys with huge upside, very, very attractive fantasy pieces, but players who aren't doing a lot right now. Javier Baez is at 242, 287, 347, with two homers and three steals and 101 plate appearances. Addison Russell is at 241, 333, 371, in 195 plate appearances. He has four homers and two steals. And Jorge Soler is at 202, 302, 361, with five homers and no steals in 139 plate appearances. So this is a pretty interesting group of players. You know, a lot of teams would kill to have this sort of young nucleus of talent. But on the Cubs, these guys are almost forgotten or second-class citizens. So it presents a bit of an interesting opportunity for Dynasty League players. So, Brett, we will lead off with you, and we'll start with Javier Baez, who has long been one of the darlings of this podcast. How do you feel about Baez right now? Give us your sort of temperature check on him.
Baez is doing some really good things as far as his skill set is concerned. And the problem is that it's not really translating into too much fantasy value right now. And part of that is because he's not really getting consistent playing time with all of the depth that you already mentioned in the Cubs organization. But Baez, a year ago was someone who had extreme contact issues, but extreme power. And I think we're seeing a new version of him, a version of him that makes better contact, that makes more contact, and a version of him that doesn't hit for as much power. So it's going to be, I kind of don't like to take any changes like this too seriously when someone is not really playing full time. And he's gotten barely over 100 plate appearances so far this year, and the strikeout rate is pretty much half of what it was when he made his debut in 2014. So he's clearly worked on that. He's clearly also not getting any more patient. In fact, he's probably getting less patient, and one probably has quite a bit to do with the other. But long term, I think this is a really positive development for him. And even if it doesn't really coalesce into fantasy value for another year or two, I think this gives him a little bit higher of a fantasy floor, even if it does slightly reduce his ceiling, especially with the power. Or how are we going to do this? Is everyone else going to talk about Baez? Or am I going to throw it off to someone else about to talk about Soler or Russell? I'm unclear on the rules.
I think we should focus on Baez for a second. I mean, we don't have to spend this long on every player, but I know he's been such a sort of linchpin of discussion on this podcast. I think he's perhaps worth dwelling on. Craig, do you have any additional Baez thoughts?
Yeah, just really briefly, because I do agree with Brett. I think one thing to keep in mind is that, despite the increased contact rate, he only has a BABIP of 280. And, we always talk about, sometimes you can earn that BABIP with soft contact. There's nothing in his profile that's extremely worrisome. He's not hitting the ball as hard as you like per those numbers, which can always be iffy. But, this is a guy that, given his swing and bat speed, I'm not worried about him making hard contact in the long term. So as long as he can, maintain this contact rate or, some level of this bump down in strikeout rate, I agree with Brett that the long-term the long-term prognosis is really positive, despite the struggles now. Yeah,
I don't want to get carried away because I know it is only 100 plate appearances, but I think the strikeout rate is really, really important. And even if I don't think it's going to stay at below 18%, I mean, if he strikes out at a 25% clip, that's a substantial improvement over what we've seen in the past and maybe what I thought he was capable of even. So I think, Craig, you hit the nail on the head. I am not worried about his power or his hard contact. That's who he is. That's what his swing is. I'm just worried about his selectivity. So as long as he can rein in a little bit, I think this is a good sign for his future, even if the immediate dividends aren't what you hoped they would be.
Yeah, and we should note, he's not walking, but that's, you know, that's really not a huge part of his game.
Right, I don't know if he ever is going to or really has to for fantasy.
And the other thing, just to put it out there, was, you know, you read their stat lines coming in. He hit a massive home run today. So, you know, maybe, you know, you don't want to read too much into anything, but we know the power is still there. I mean, he absolutely unloaded on one today. So, you know, it's just worth noting that the power, it doesn't look like it's gone. It just hasn't come out yet.
Yes. All right. So let's move on to the man who sort of usurped Baez as the Cubs shortstop of the present and future, Addison Russell, who is almost a full year younger than Baez. That always blows my mind. Or no, I'm sorry, he's more than a full year younger than Baez, which is sort of crazy. Craig, we'll stay with you. Sort of the second year in a row, we've seen pretty much more of the same from Russell. He's got decent pop, but he is not hitting for a good average despite pretty strong BABIP. The good news is his walk rate is up and his strikeout rate is down, but the overall line still isn't that impressive. What have you made of Russell so far this year?
Yeah, I've been pretty disappointed just in terms of output, because this is a guy I thought was going to take a really big step forward. Like, I thought he had a chance to be one of the most improved guys in the league, and part of that was because I really believe that somewhere inside him is a guy who can approach, you know, 480 to 500 slugging percentage, and right now he's well below 400. So I think that's the big issue here. You know, I'm not sure that we're talking about anyone who comes up to like a 290 average, but I definitely, in my mind's eye, saw him as a potential 260 to 270 guy who would hit for power. And that's just not happening right now. And, you know, he's somewhat lucky that Baez, despite his process improvements, hasn't had a lot of success so far, because I think he could be edged out if Baez starts producing. And, you know, that's not a shade on his talent, but, you know, the Cubs are in the business of winning games, and both of these guys are immensely talented. So it's been a little disappointing that he hasn't really solidified that role the way I thought he would. How have you seen him, Ben?
I think that is largely right. I don't have a lot to add. I've always, I think, been a little bit of the low man on Russell in the podcast. Not to say I don't think he was going to be an outstanding, a very good fantasy proposition and an outstanding major leaguer, but for me, I'm trying to fight a little bit of confirmation bias almost, in that I don't think I've ever seen him as quite the uber special player that some others have. And I don't think now is the right time to sell him, because he is still so young and there is still so much time to improve. But I'm not sure if the Russell that we want to see is as close to actuating as we want him to be, if that makes any sense, Brett.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think, you know, what you're buying with Russell is you're buying the the translation of his prospect pedigree and the tools that he flashes. I think there is a lot of really good fantasy value in there, and you know, I thought a little bit more of it would come out this year than we've seen so far, and I'm still not sure that a good amount won't come out in the second half. He sort of goes through periods where he struggles, and then he seems to make some adjustments, and then goes back to struggling a little bit. He can't quite seem to turn the corner. But I do think he's going to turn the corner, and when he does, I think he does make enough good hard contact that I think it's reasonable for him to hit in the 270 to 280 range with like 20 to 25 homers. Any steals he adds on top of that is gravy, and you know, he's got the the combination of instincts and speed to reach double digits. And I don't think he's ever going to be a 20 steal guy or anything, but you know, I still think that future is there for him. You know, but it is important to remember that he, you know, he's closer to turning 22 than he is to turning 23. And even, you know, on a team like the Cubs, where, you know, they have a pretty stacked offense from top to bottom, they can give him all of, you know, they can give him all of the time that he needs if he doesn't get usurped by Javi Baez or someone else in the organization. So I am, I guess, a little optimistic for the second half this year, but I'm still generally very optimistic on Russell for his career.
And just the one other thing I meant to add, and I have forgotten, was, you know, we talked about Baez's improvements in process. Russell is walking 3% more, or 3 percentage points more than he did last year, and striking out about 3 percentage points less. So, I mean, he's also shown that type of improvement in terms of process at the plate in that respect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Very good point. Okay, so we'll move on to sort of the least heralded out of this trio, Jorge Soler. I personally was expecting pretty big things from Soler this year. I grabbed him as my, you know, OF5 or as one of my utility bats in quite a few redraft leagues, and I was trying to buy low on him in some dynasty leagues this offseason as well. He is 24 now. We've obviously seen glimpses of his immense talent, but overall so far his MLB track record is not super pretty. Brett, is this just a bump in the road, or has Soler dropped a few notches in your eyes?
I think, well, it's the answer is sort of a mix of both. I don't think he's dropped so much in my eyes, but, you know, talking about him compared to Baez and Russell is, you know, it underscores how great prospects Baez and Russell were, and how much potential they have. I don't really think all that differently of Soler. I think he's still someone who could hit 30 homers a year at the major league level. I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of batting average to speak of. I don't think there's going to be really any speed to speak of, but that's kind of what was expected in the first place. If he can hit 250 to 260, then, you know, he'll be a pretty valuable fantasy outfielder. But I don't think this year is causing me to be too much less confident that he can do that than I was coming into the season. Ben, what about you?
Not terribly, but I guess maybe I didn't fully appreciate how much I shouldn't be banking on a super good average with Soler. You know, when you say it, it seems very very obvious, but I guess I always sort of thought of him as a guy who would at least be able to not hurt me in average, or maybe help me in average a tiny bit, and I think that is maybe the one area in which I am starting to budge. I think obviously the one category in which my outlook hasn't changed at all is power. I think he clearly has pop, but now I'm wondering if it comes with, you know, more of a 255 to 270 average rather than an average that is truly an asset. Craig?
Yeah, I'll try and be brief. I think, you know, one thing to keep in mind is that we saw Gregory Polanco play about 240 games of uninspiring baseball, basically, over his first two seasons, 2014, 2015, and he's been a monster this season. And Soler is at just about that mark. He's at about 250 games into his career right now. So I think that should just be a reference point in terms of not jumping off too quickly. There's obviously a lot to be worried about now. Again, not to harp on Babbitt too much, but he's at 235 this year. Despite a batted ball mix that's not atrocious. It's a little heavy on fly balls, but not to the point that you'd think 235. And I guess the thing I'll be looking at going forward is kind of his batted ball profile, because it's a pretty big difference between 2015 and 2016, in that he had a 1.42 ground ball to fly ball ratio last year, 1.46 the year before that in limited time. This year he's at 0.72. So, you know, again, comparing to BABIP, I think you have to take the batted ball profile into account. And if he keeps lifting the ball without enough power, that's obviously going to be a concern. If he can get back to hitting it on a line or hitting on the ground a little bit more, I would expect that average to come up pretty quickly.
All right, so Craig, since you are the one who first started this crazy idea that we have, why don't you lead off with the split up of shares? If you had 100 shares of stock and you had to split them between these three, how would you go?
So I'm going to go 50 to Addison Russell, 30 to Baez, 20 to Soler.
Fair enough. Yeah. I think I am going to... This is going to seem like a super... I keep going back and forth on this. I think I am going to go 40 to Russell, 35 to Baez, and 25 to Soler. Brett?
I am going to go 45 to Russell, 40 to Baez, and 15 to Soler.
God, I thought I'd be the most aggressive on Baez, but... Once again, Brett's me. Okay, so seems like by and large we're somewhat on the same page, and that it's Russell small gap, Baez bigger gap, Soler.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we'll move on now to our first batch of pitchers, which is a pretty interesting mix. We have Matt Moore, who has come back this year to post some pretty weird numbers, honestly. 5.31 ERA. 4.52 FIP, striking out 22% of batters and walking 7.5% of batters, and that was in 57 innings. Carlos Rodon, who has a 4.24 ERA, 4.2 FIP, striking out 21% of batters and walking 8% of batters, and that is in 57 innings. And then finally, we have Marcus Stroman, who's at a 4.46 ERA, 3.68 FIP, striking out 16.5% of batters, walking 6.5% of batters, and that is in about 75 innings. So this time, Craig, we'll start with you. I think we started with Brett last time, but it was so long ago, I can't remember. But we will start with you and Matt Moore. Still only 26 years old, but about to turn 27. Are you about ready to throw in the towel, or is what you've seen so far this year encouraging for you?
I'm honestly a little concerned. I don't know how someone with his stuff manages to miss bats at this weak a level. And I know that kind of thing would lead you to believe that he'd get better, but he wasn't notably better than that last year. And you know, that's a smaller sample size, but if you combine them, you're still not getting more than about, you know, a 17% strikeout rate over his last 100 innings. And, you know, 2014 before that, he was at just under 21%. I don't know if it's anything to do with the knee surgery and coming back from it. I wouldn't assume that it is. And he is phenomenal at getting ground balls, but that only can go so far, I think, especially in fantasy. You know, strikeouts are generally a category, and ground ball percentage is not. So, you know, he plays on he pitches in the Rogers Center, which is a tough place to pitch. And it's, I think, not the easiest place to have ground balls just because of how fast the field is. And, you know, that means he's highly dependent on the defense behind him. So, you know, if you want to rely on his FIP at 3.68 as opposed to his ERA, I guess that's fine. But he's dealing with a defense behind him at all times, and if he's in a tough environment for that defense, just because of the how the field plays, you know, that's going to matter, and it could lead to higher ERAs than FIPs going forward. Brett, do you have a different read on the situation?
Yeah, I wonder with Stroman how much his effectiveness is hurt by throwing fastballs more often. Just because, you know, the one thing we always hear about Stroman is that he's sort of one of the masters of tunneling. So, you know, he makes it difficult for hitters to pick up which pitch is coming. So it seems intuitive that for him to throw a pitch almost 60% of the time, which he's throwing his two-seamer, is probably not the best idea if that is what you are relying on to miss bats and get weak contact. But, beyond that, I mean, I think he'll be fine. I don't know how much confidence I have that he will strike out more than like seven and a half batters per nine, even when things get good again.
I largely agree with that. So rather than elaborating, I'm going to move us on to Rodon. Brett, pretty similar strikeout rate to last year. The walk rate's gotten a lot better, but he's allowing more home runs, and the ERA has really suffered partially as a function of that. What have you made of his 2016?
It's, you know, the walks are still a problem, although, you know, they're slightly less of a problem than in 2015, although not towards the end of 2015 when he was really good. You know, Rodon has had a pretty tough schedule so far, and you know, he started off at Oakland and at Minnesota and had two really strong starts to start the year, but he's pitched against Texas twice. He's pitched against both Kansas City twice, although they're not a particularly effective offense these days. Against Boston, against Baltimore, he has not had the easiest sledding. So he's also not necessarily going to have the easiest sledding, being in the American League and being in a reasonably tough park for pitchers. But I think I still very much believe in Rodon's talent. I think, you know, he showed last year that he can go through stretches where he has his control and command in hand enough to be pretty dominant. And you know, I think he'll get there, and I think he's, you know, he's closer now than he was when he came up, but you know, I don't expect him to be a top, you know, top 30 starter this year. I just think that next year, the year after, he still has all the ingredients to be a top 25 starter who can strike out a batter per inning while keeping everything else enough in check for that to matter. Craig?
Yeah.
Ben, go ahead.
I was only going to add that I think it's important to remember that, I mean, this Rodon had fewer than 40 innings in the minor leagues total. And I know he was billed as a very advanced prospect coming out of college, but he has been and is doing all of his learning at the major league level. That's all I was going to add.
Yeah, I think that's right. I don't really have much to add, so I'm
happy to
move along.
All right. So we'll take a slight step down from Rodon to Matt Moore, who was sort of Rodon before Rodon was Rodon. And it's been a wild ride to follow his career. You know, you go back to 2013, he really looked like he was going to be sort of the next dominant left-handed starter, maybe at very worst a Francisco Liriano-type player. And the two and now a third season since have not really gone as planned. He's certainly missing more bats than he has in a while this year, which is great to see. He's even walking fewer people than we've seen, which is also encouraging. But allowing a lot more contact in the ERA is not terribly pretty. So, Craig, what do you do with Matt Moore in a 20-team TDGX size league at this point? You know, obviously you shouldn't drop him, I don't think, but he's also not someone you want to be reliably starting every time he's out. So what do you view him as right now?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the vexing thing about a guy like Moore is that he's liable to post, you know, 8 to 10 strikeouts anytime he takes the mound, but he's also liable to get bombed, and he's kind of more liable to get bombed when he takes the mound these days. So the thing I would do, and it's obviously doesn't take a genius to figure out, I would wait till he strings together, you know, 2 or 3 good to decent starts, and then look to sell him. And I don't think you need to get, you know, a dollar for a dollar in this sense. I think you can sell at a discount, because the reality is that given his repeated uncertainty, he is not someone that you're going to be comfortable relying on. And if that's the case, then, you know, what use is it to have him on your roster if you're uncomfortable rolling him out every time you do so? So, I think it's a tough situation with him, because there are some positives, but this is years, this is years in the making that he's not been reliable and he's been a volatile asset. And at this point, I would just be looking to rid myself of him. Brett, what's your read on the situation?
I don't think I'm quite that negative, but it's certainly a compressed version of that. I think, you know, the strikeouts and walks are positives, but, you know, he really has to stop. He really has to stop giving up so many homers, and pitching in Tampa is good for him. But, you know, he's the sad thing about it is that he's made almost all of his starts in parks that are not easy to give up that many home runs in. He's made 7 of his 10 starts at home, and 2 of his other starts were in Seattle and in Miami. So when he starts pitching in Fenway and Camden Yards and more starts in Yankee Stadium, one start in Yankee Stadium, but it's just going to get more difficult for him. And it's tough to be confident about Moore at this point.
So with that in mind, Brett, you can lead off our share game this time around. How would you divvy up your shares between these three?
I would say, 75 for Rodon, 20 for Stroman, and 5 for Moore. Craig?
I don't want to be hot takey. I think that's about right. I would probably go 70-30-0, Rodon, Stroman, Moore. It's going to sound worse than it is for me to say 0 for Moore, but I just, against these two, it's nothing. I don't think he's worthless or not worth a flyer, but given what he's done his career to date, I don't see it, especially against Stroman and Rodon. Ben?
Craig, you really took my legs out, because I was going to go 70-29-1. So... You really murdered me on that one.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I was gonna give more than 1%, you know, because he does have the lefty swing and miss going for him. But
you really should have given him the 2%.
Oh no. Well, more or less, I did. You know. Oh, yeah, and true. a very helpful message from George, who says I could have just given Rodon 69. George, you are absolutely right. You are so right that I changed my answer to a very nice 69 shares for Rodon, 30 for Stroman, and 1 for Moore. Okay, so now we will advance to slightly elder frustrating pitchers, which, what a beautiful sentence for Dynasty League owners. So we'll talk about Chris Archer, Sonny Gray, and Felix Hernandez, who I am sure have... Each of them have caused many of our listeners a whole lot of stress at various points this season. So we'll start with Chris Archer, who has a 4.75 ERA, 4.59 whip, and is striking out 25.5% of batters, walking 10.5% of batters. And all of this is coming in 66 innings. Sonny Gray, 6.19% ERA, 5.14% FIP, 18.5% K rate, 10.8% walk rate, and that's in 48 innings. And of course, Gray is on the DL right now. And then finally, we get to Felix Hernandez. This is his first ever DL stint, correct?
I think so, yeah.
Sounds right.
I think it is. And Felix has a 2.86 ERA, 4.10 FIP, a 20% strikeout rate, about a 10% walk rate, and all of this is coming in 63 innings. So you would have been, you know, well within your means to start your fantasy pitching staff with any one of these three pitchers in a TGX size league to come into the season. With the possible exception of Hernandez, you'd be pretty disappointed if you did with any of them. We'll start with Archer, and because it's Archer, we'll start with Craig, since you know he's long been your boy. What's up?
Yeah, it's not great. 20%. What's up is his homer per fly ball rate. 20%. That's problematic. So you know the strikeouts are mostly there, but he's just missing in the zone constantly. And I mean, you know, 10% walk rate will tell you he's missing out of the zone too. You know, he's got a 4.75 ERA, as you mentioned, and he's earned every bit of it at this point. I watched a decent number of his starts, and it just, he doesn't seem to have the feel that he obviously had last year, but even going back to 2014, when he had something of a breakout, and you know he wasn't missing as many bats those days, but he seemed to have a little bit better idea, kind of where the ball was going, even just within the zone. It seemed like he could at least put it in a quadrant and not run everything back over the middle. And to me, that really seems kind of what's happening to him these days. He's missing in the middle and he's missing up. And you know, we talked about Moore having that good park to pitch in. Archer has the same exact park, and it holds home runs well, and yet he's still giving up all these bombs. You know, I'm concerned just because he doesn't look very confident, and that's not exactly something you want to base your projection on. But I do think that at some point he gets that confidence back, and he starts, you know, finishing a little bit better and keeping the ball down. But I don't have any confidence that that's going to happen, you know, in the next 3 to 5 starts. I think it could be a little bit while he struggles. And, you know, long term, I think he's fine. But in the short term, I am pretty concerned. Ben, what is your take on him? I know you've seen him when the Red Sox have played him.
Yeah, no, Craig, I think you largely hit it on the head in that I'm not super nervous about how Archer is going to perform long term, but in the interim, I am not super confident. Since we are talking only dynasty leagues, I do think it's worth pointing out that Archer is older than people think. You know, he's going to turn 28 later this season, so that gives me a little more pause than it would if he was a lot younger. But you know, the velocity hasn't dropped or anything like that. I guess for me, more I just think last year was the very best Archer we're going to see. And I don't think that is necessarily the sort of barometer we should be measuring him against. I think that was his, you know, 95th or 100% outcome. And that, you know, if we're looking at something closer to 85% of that moving forward, is more where I would pigeonhole Archer. So I do certainly expect the ERA to take a pretty hearty step down from 4.75, but I don't know how many more sub 3.5 ERA seasons I'm looking for from Archer. Brett?
Yeah.
Two things I want to touch on, mostly because I don't want to overlap with what you guys said. The thing about him pitching at home is extremely important, and it's been very, very very extreme this year. He's got a 2.03 ERA in 5 starts at home, and he has a 7.5 0.13 ERA on the road. Now he didn't really have much of a split last year, so I don't expect anything like that to continue. But you know, when he's giving up too many home runs, you'd expect to see a disproportionate split like that, given where he's going to play most of his road games. But going back to the general theme, I mean, this is essentially the Chris Archer we were promised back 5 years ago when he was a prospect, when he was not, you know, your highest level pitching prospect. He was a guy who was going to miss a lot of bats and miss a lot of the plate, and he's really doing that this year. I mean, the strikeouts are great, and they cover over a lot of sins. But yeah, I think the rest of it improves, and I think he comes much closer to the 2015 version than he's showing now.
So when you say that, Brett, do you think 2015 is repeatable for him, or do you think that's the best Archer we will have seen?
I think it's probably the best Archer we've seen, but I don't think it's not repeatable. I don't think that was the step forward and he might best it. I think if anything, he might have another strong year or two and he could come close to matching it. But yeah, I think in the end, I think 2015 ends up being his career year.
Okay. Fair enough. So let's talk about a pitcher who is sort of the antithesis of Archer in a lot of ways from a fantasy point of view. In Gray, you know, not an explosive swing and miss guy, but a guy who didn't issue a lot of free passes and someone with a pretty reliably low ERA. Brett, what do you make of his 2016? Are you chalking it all up to injury, or have you seen any sort of regression in skills?
You know, I'm chalking almost all of it up to injury and small sample. You know, Gray, unlike everyone else, Gray still is dealing. He only had 9 starts, and you know, the strikeout rate was about as expected. I think the walk rate was certainly elevated, and so was the home run rate. But once he ends up on the DL, you kind of retroactively give him a little bit of a pass for the period of time before he went on the DL. So I'm not that concerned about Gray from a performance standpoint. I think assuming the injury is not major, and it doesn't seem like it's major at this point, I think a couple, maybe 2 strong starts after he comes back is enough to pretty much make everyone forget that they worried about Sonny Gray. Ben?
No, I think that is entirely right. I have nothing to add. Craig?
Yeah, the only thing I was going to say, I also attribute it to injury. And while shoulders are scary, I'm not particularly concerned with Gray's injury long term. Is the only thing I would add to it.
Okay, so let's stay in the division and go to Felix, who's on the DL for the first time. You know, great year by ERA, but the strikeouts are down, the walks are up, and this is coming after his worst year as a professional ever, at least since he was very young and just breaking into the league. I know, Craig, it feels kind of strange to say because he's been the definition of a safe thing from a pitcher, but are you finally a little worried about Felix or no?
Yeah, I am. I think, you know, one of the things that gave us confidence in years past is that, you know, we've seen him basically adjust to losing velocity since since he came into the league. He was, 97 well as a rookie, I remember, and he's kind of slowly declined. He had a couple mile per hour drop off in from 2011 to 2012, basically, and he adapted almost seamlessly. He's lost a little more velocity now. He's down about 2 miles per hour from last year, and you know the issue with that is, as good as he was at adapting before, going from 94 to 92 might not be great, but going from upper 92 to upper 90 is even more of kind of a dramatic thing. If you're looking at kind of on a curve, it's a bigger problem. And, you know, so you combine that with now the actual injury. And it's funny because, like you said, he's got a great ERA. He's probably been the most valuable pitcher of the three that we're talking about in fantasy leagues. And I certainly don't question his ability to adjust or adapt, but I think there's only so much you can adjust to throwing 90-91 compared to 93-94 and get by with his other stuff. I still think he's going to be a useful guy, a mid-rotation guy. I just wonder if he's not going to be something closer to, I don't know, maybe like 2014 James Shields, where it's like useful and it's going to be a lot of innings, as opposed to a real top of the rotation fantasy guy. Brett?
So I think I'm a little bit higher on Felix than you are. You know, I tend to build in a little bit of confidence that elite starting pitchers will get through the adjustment period and continue to perform well from a fantasy standpoint. You know, Hernandez hasn't really been all that bad this year, and you know, the velocity's been down, but it's been ticking up. You know he has seasons where he starts low. He's, you know, obviously never had a season where he started this low, but his, you know, his velocity was up almost a mile an hour from April to May. So as far as short term good feelings about how he's going to perform and whether he can, you know, really be still be the ace that people are relying on him to be in their deep dynasty leagues, I think his velocity when he comes back is going to play a little bit of a factor there. You know, it's certainly not out of the realm of possibility that he could come back and start throwing, you know, 92-ish again. He's ticking up in that direction. But honestly, even without it, I mean, the strikeouts are fine, you know, at least as far as what you'd expect from him at this point. He still pitches in Safeco. You know, he is, even at 90 to 91 miles an hour, I think he's still a pretty good and safe SP2. So the concern, I don't have a ton of concern long term about Felix, although I don't, you know, that's with factoring in the fact that I don't think he's anything more than a very low end SP1 at peak at this point. Ben?
No, I think the two of you combined have hit on most of what I want to hit on. I'm not terribly panicked when it comes to Felix. So with that in mind, I guess I'll go first this time with the percentages, just in the interest of fairness. So in dynasty leagues moving forward, I think I would go, I'll go 40% Gray and 30% apiece to Archer and Felix. Brett?
I'm going to go 35 to Felix, 33 to Archer, and 32 to Gray, because shruggy face pitchers.
Craig?
I was on mute. I pulled a Brett. I was on mute. So well, I was saying to myself only that this is the toughest one that we've had. And I think I'm going to go. Oh, that's tough. Okay. I'm going to go 45 Gray. No, sorry. 40 Gray, 35 Archer, and 25 Felix.
That's fair. It's so weird talking about these three players as potentially on the decline. It's like we live in a dystopian society or something weird like that. While we're on the subject of dystopia, do you guys know what the new theme of the month is for Loot Crate?
Just have no idea. I hope it's power again.
Is it Prince?
It is. Oh, God.
No, it is not Prince. Before we overdose on lulls, it is Dystopia, oddly enough. Dystopia is the new theme of the month on Loot Crate. So we are only briefly removed from our exciting initial Loot Crate endorsement. But the good news is that we all loved our May Loot Crates so much that we have decided to endorse Loot Crate once again. And for those of you who are new to the program, Loot Crate is a monthly subscription box service for geeks, nerds, comic book lovers, and pop culture aficionados. Every month, subscribers receive a mystery box full of collectibles, figurines, apparel, and memorabilia. And, you know, these boxes do not come cheap. They have at least $45 in value. And many items are exclusively created for the a thriving and abundant Loot Crate community. Each crate has a theme centered around a major franchise or a theatrical release or an event. And this month's theme, as we have mentioned, is Dystopia. So if you are a fan of Fallout or Terminator or The Matrix or BioShock or RoboCop, and I entirely know what three of those things are, then Loot Crate is a good buy for you this month. Craig, are you more of a Fallout guy or a BioShock guy?
You know, I've never played either.
So doesn't answer my question.
I'll say Fallout.
Right.
Why not?
Right.
I think and they're Brett, manufactured I think, by. I think they're manufactured by Bethesda. That's where I live. So.
That's very true. So you have a very personal and abiding connection there.
Yeah.
Brett, I think you were only like 30 when Terminator came out. So what memories does this conjure for you?
It conjures a lot of good memories. I was a big Robert Patrick fan way back in the day.
Literally, don't know who that is.
Yeah, I have no clue.
Come on.
But perhaps Robert Patrick learned all about Robert Patrick in Loot Crate.
He was the T-1000. His career has gone so well, maybe he's in the crate.
I can't believe that you managed any indignation behind that, Brett. That's very impressive on your part, to be even a little bit offended.
Come on. He has been in stuff, though. I'm pretty sure he was the really jacked werewolf's dad in True Blood.
This is not going
to... I would love a Loot Crate theme of just Brett reading old things. That would be my Loot Crate of choice.
Stay tuned for next week when Brett reads the Old Testament.
Oh God! Okay.
Was he the guy on the X-Files? Was he Doggett on the X-Files?
I don't know. Shockingly, I didn't watch the X-Files.
God damn it!
Okay, before we get in trouble, I'm going to move us on to.
Hey everybody, George Bissell here, Tino Podcast producer. We had some unforeseen technical difficulties with our first segment, so we're going to skip ahead past our groups of three segment, cutting that short, and we're going to bring on Jim Callis of MLB Pipeline. So what you're going to hear next after a quick break is Brett Sayer and Craig Goldstein talking to Jim Callis about the MLB draft. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back here on Tino.
And now we are joined by our aforementioned special guest. If you follow the draft at all, you know Jim Callis. He is joining us from you know his stuff at MLB Pipeline, and most of you know all him from many years at Baseball America before that. Jim, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Oh yeah, thanks for having me on. It's always love talking draft this type of year, time of year, so no problem.
It is a great time to do it.
So Jim, I guess just to start off really broadly, looking at the draft, there's kind of been some talk about the draft being down, and at least from my perception, it does seem a little messy at the top, but it seems like there's some depth. I don't know if you could speak to kind of how strong the draft is overall. And, you know, I was listening to, Baseball America's podcast on the draft, and they kind of compared it to the last couple of years. And I guess I was interested to hear what you had to say, you know, on the strength of this draft class relative to maybe 2014 and 2015.
Yeah, I think when you're looking at drafts, they do tend to get judged by the talent at the top. And in any draft, whether it's perceived to be good or bad, I mean, there's going to be good players in the fourth round. There's going to be good players in the 10th round. You just have to go out and find them. I think most years you talk to scouts and you're like, I'm not blown away by the quality of this draft. And I think that's just the quality of the draft most years, if that makes sense. The teams do such an aggressive job of signing players out of high school that, you know, it's not like it was 30 years ago. And, you know, Barry Bonds is a second-round pick, and he wants $66,000, and the Giants hold firm at 60, so he goes to school over $6,000. And you go back and you look at these great drafts in the 80s that, you had guys like Will Clark and Randy Johnson and Barry Larkin, and you go on and on and on, guys who were early-round picks out of high school who didn't sign. And those guys, you know, by the end of the 80s, you had two of some of the best drafts in baseball in the mid-80s, in baseball history, because you had these unbelievable college crops. And I think the teams started to realize, we're identifying these guys out of high school. Why are we letting them go to college? And so starting toward the end of the 80s, bonuses started to explode and rose almost, you know, with very little restraint for the next decade. And it was a lot, you know, it was very easy to sign guys out of high school, and teams were aggressive about it. So you just don't get those college crops that everybody raved about 30 years ago. And then, you know, incidentally, I think that's where kind of the misnomer that, the college players are so much better than the high school players comes. Well, yeah, if you don't sign the high school players and you let them go to college, the college players are going to look a lot better. If you're signing, a lot of players out of high school, the high school players are probably going to look better than the college players in the long run. I mean, talent's talent. But anyway, getting back to the question, at the top of the draft, yes. I don't think the top of the draft is very strong at all. And it's weaker. You know, we were saying this last year, the top of the draft. There's no clear 1-1, and all these pitchers get hurt. Well, you know, and the comparison I make, and I wrote this a couple of weeks ago on our site, is, okay, you know, Dansby Swanson clearly would be the number one pick in this year's draft. Alex Bregman would clearly be the number one pick in this year's draft. Brendan Rodgers would clearly be the number one pick in this year's draft. Andrew Benintendi would clearly be the number one pick in this year's draft. If you look at the pitchers, I think I'd take Dylan Tate over A.J. Puck, who's probably going to be the number one pick in this year's draft. I'd take Tyler Jay over A.J. Puck. I'd take Carson Fulmer over A.J. Puck. So last year was considered to be mediocre at the top. And when I wrote my story, I think if you combine the two drafts, you probably take, if you had a combined draft, like at least 7 of the top 10 picks would come from last year's draft. So I do think the top of this draft isn't blowing people away, especially when your top two prospects are high school pitchers, which the industry is scared of a little bit. But overall, I mean, there is depth in high school pitching. You know, there will be some good players in the second round, the third round. And even comparing it to 14, I mean, I was not the hugest Tyler Kolek fan in the world, but, I mean, Brady Aiken was a pretty good guy. Carlos Rodon was a pretty good guy. The college bats were a lot better, I think, than people even realized. We with Schwarber and Conforto and Trey Turner, Brandon Finnegan, Aaron Nola were quick to the big leagues. So I do think it pales in comparison to the last two drafts, but that doesn't mean there aren't good players to be found.
Yeah, our listeners are obviously thinking about this in context of their fantasy drafts when these guys get into pro ball, and the big thing that people are looking for are the safest bats with at least a good amount of upside. So for you, whether it's college or high school, who are the safest bats for you in this draft class?
I think I would just start with the bats at the top of the draft rankings. I mean, I like Kyle Lewis a lot. I mean, there's maybe a little risk. You know, he gets knocked, and I don't really buy. Oh, you know, he's in the Southern Conference. So we're not sure about his competition. Well, he played really, really good in the Cape Cod League last year, and he's dominated the Southern Conference like you'd hope. So, I mean, he's done everything he can. But, I mean, Kyle Lewis is a guy. You know, he drew a lot. He leaned the NCAA in walks going into the NCAA tournament that begins today. But I think he's got plus power, and I think he's going to hit for average, and he might steal you a couple bases. Just going down our rankings, Mickey Moniak is our top-rated high school position player. He's going to hit for average. You know, it's probably more of a 12, maybe 15 home run guy. But he's a plus runner. He'll steal some bases. Corey Ray of Louisville, he's got, you know, right now going into the tournament, 39 steals and 15 homers. He's going to be a power speed guy. Again, if you're talking fantasy purposes, doesn't matter if he winds up in center or on the corner. You know, Nick Senzel might be the best pure hitter in college baseball. You know, the question I think with him is it average power? Is it better than that? He'll show you more in BP, but it's more of a patient gap-to-gap approach during games. But I think, I mean, I'd be surprised if he didn't hit, and I think he'll have at least average power. Those are probably the four. I mean, they're our top four ranked position players, and I also think they're the best combination of, I guess, safe, where you feel like they are going to produce, but also, like, good ceilings, too. There's floor and ceiling on all four of those guys.
So moving beyond those guys, you know, let's talk about a couple of the prospects who have defensive challenges, but who still carry strong bats with them. You know, a couple of guys that come to mind there are Blake Rutherford on the prep side and Zach Collins on the college side. How good can their bats be? And in a fantasy context where, you know, where we don't really care where they how good they are on defense, as long as they play somewhere that's useful. How much should fantasy owners be paying attention to those guys?
Yeah, no, those are two good bats as well. I don't really see any defensive issues with Blake Rutherford, to be honest. I mean, I think you're hoping he can play center, but, you know, he profiles on a corner, and for fantasy purposes, you know, he's an outfielder. He can definitely play the outfield, and, you know, he could possibly be a 280 hitter with 20-plus home runs a year, and he can run well, too. So I'm not worried about him. With Collins, yeah, Collins is one of the better college bats available. There's power. He's going to hit for average. He's very good. You know, the question, or I guess the cautionary thing with him is I would not draft. I mean, he's a catcher. He'll be drafted by whoever drafts him in the middle of the first round as a catcher. I would not count on him for fantasy purposes as being a catcher in the big leagues. If he is, he has the potential to be one of the better fantasy catchers around, but he's probably, I would be very surprised if he does not wind up as a first baseman in the long run.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think, you know, when we're talking about guys like that, there's obviously some risk tolerance in fantasy, because the pool of players tends to be smaller than it is in real life. You tend to want to go for those impact guys. Are there any type that you see standing out as kind of people can hone in on if they have a higher risk tolerance, if they're looking for impact and are willing to take that type of risk?
Yeah, I mean, you could, you know, Delvin Perez is an interesting guy. I mean, he gets not compared, but kind of lumped in with Carlos Correa because he's a Puerto Rican shortstop, and that's kind of extreme. But, you know, he has a chance to be pretty good. You know, there are little questions on his bat, but if he hits, you know, you're talking about a shortstop who's going to give you above average offense from the shortstop position. You know, Buddy Reed is a guy who maybe could be a real nice stolen base source. There's questions on his bat out of Florida. He's kind of slid maybe toward the end of the first round, you know, beginning of the second. I mean, those are a couple guys I think about with risk. I mean, there's other guys. I mean, Joe Rizzo, I don't really think there's risk. I think he's one of the better high school hitters in the draft, and you're trying to figure out what position he's going to wind up playing. But I think he's going to hit. You know, I'm just not sure where he winds up exactly.
You talked about a little bit about Corey Ray before, and just mentioned Buddy Reed as well. Are there any other players in the draft class that are particularly speedy that could be strong stolen base threats, even if they even if they do have a long way to go with some of their other tools, or have a, you know, have a big gap between their future projection.
Yeah, you know, there aren't a ton of like big time athletes. I mean, Mickey Moniak can run; he's a plus runner. You know, I mentioned Buddy Reed. Buddy Reed's faster than either one of those guys. There's just some questions on his bat. Taylor Trammell's interesting, high school outfielder from Georgia, the Georgia Class A football player of the year, ran for almost 2,500 yards and 36 touchdowns last fall. Yeah, he's a little bit raw because he's a two-sport guy, but he can really run. Just scanning here, there's no like 80 runner. There's no Billy Hamilton, I think, that's hiding out there that's going to go in the top couple rounds. You know, Thomas Jones is another football player who's a well above average runner. He's a high school outfielder from South Carolina. You know, Anthony Greer's interesting. You know, he's had a real nice year in the SEC for Auburn, and he can run, but I don't know if he makes the best use of his speed, and guys are a little bit worried about the bat. So, you know, possible stolen bases there, but risk with him.
Okay. Three of the big prep arms that that people have been talking about, at least recently, seems to me are Riley Pint, Matt Manning, and Braxton Garrett. How do the three of them compare to each other for you? And are there other prep pitchers that you would sort of lump in if when fantasy owners are sort of moving into the prep arm phase of their draft, usually looking for upside? Are there other guys you would put into that group? I mean, obviously, Jason Groom aside, he's sort of the top dog there. But as far as that next wave,
yeah, I mean, the depth of this draft is high school pitching. We've got six high school pitchers in our top 13. You know, Groom is one, Pine is two, Garrett is 10, Manning's 11, Forrest Whitley's 12, and Ian Anderson's 13. Yeah, I mean, they're all real interesting. I mean, Jason Groom, you know, you're talking about a well above average fastball plus curveball and pretty good polish. You know, Pine's got the best pure stuff. You know, he's hit 102 miles an hour. He's got a plus changeup. He's got a plus curveball, but you know, the delivery and the mechanics and the command aren't quite what you'd want them to be. So it's probably higher ceiling, more risk there. You know, Braxton Garrett is the most polished of those guys and probably has the best curveball of them. You know, solid pitches across the board. What I kind of like about him, if this makes any sense, is, you know, a lot of guys who throw mid-90s in high school, doesn't seem like their arms hold up. And Braxton Garrett's low 90s and more of a pitcher than just a guy who blows away the radar gun. And so maybe he's the best bet to stay healthy of them. And he's left-handed like Groom is. You know, Manning, you know, fresh arm, basketball background. His dad, you know, played in the NBA. You know, I think this guy's going to continue getting better. You know, he's hit 99 miles an hour. His curveball's coming along. You know, Whitley's a big physical 6'7" guy who throws in the mid 90s with a very good curveball as well. And his changeups come along. And Anderson's probably been the hardest of these guys to see because he's in upstate New York with the weather, and he had an oblique injury, and he had a little bout of pneumonia. So he hasn't been as easy to see, but, I mean, he can hit 95, and his slider's pretty sharp, and it'll be interesting. I mean, I don't necessarily think all these guys will go as high as we have them ranked just because the industry is concerned about the risk with high school pitchers. And, you know, I mean, fantasy baseball, I mean, these are all, you know, I think you characterize, you know, your high upside, you know, prep pitchers as high-risk, high-reward types. Although, like I said, if you're looking to maybe – you know, get an upside arm and mitigate the risk a little bit. You know, Braxton Garrett, I have less concerns about him than the other guys. I think he's probably got the highest floor of those guys, and that's not to sell his ceiling short by any means.
Just out of curiosity, I know that there are some guys who have obviously had some injuries kind of pick up and drop their stock as we head into the draft. I'm thinking of a guy like Dalton Jeffries, something like that. Are there any other names, or even if you could speak to Jeffries, kind of how those injuries have affected him? It's obviously not a positive, but how it affects the industry's outlook of him going forward, that would be great.
Yeah, you know, last year it seemed like we were losing a pitcher every week, like to an injury. And this year that has not been the case. Yeah, you know, I was in fact asking Scounder the other day, like, are there any injury situations I need to be aware of as we're getting real close to the draft that have cropped up? And not really. I mean, Jeffries is the most significant one. I mean, he might have been the second college pitcher drafted. He got off to a great start this year, and then he got hurt, and it was supposed to be a calf strain that, I don't know, somehow it spread to his shoulder. I don't know how that works, but it's actually a shoulder injury, and he missed some time and you know, came back a little bit at the end of the year, but not anything real long. Or you're, you know, it was good to see him back on the mound, but it wasn't like you got to see him go, you know, 7-8 inning start type of situation. You know, I'll be interested to see where he goes because, like, you know, he did get back on the mound, so you're not feeling like, Jesus, guy needs surgery and he's not going to pitch for a while. And he probably would have been the second college pitcher drafted, and the college pitchers, you know, there might only be one or two taken in the top half of the first round, and it's kind of a mishmash after that. It would not surprise me if teams like, you know, whatever they determine is going on with his medicals, and they're fine with it. And, you know, there won't be 30 teams, but I'm sure there'll be some teams say, you know what, we feel okay about this. You know, he could still sneak into the first round somewhere. But, you know, fantasy purposes, I'd be honest, I mean, it's not like he's a big stuff guy. He can pitch. Mm-hmm. And with the shoulder injury this year, you know, he did come back from it. He probably would not be a guy, if I'm looking to invest in 2016 draft guys for fantasy purposes, I probably would not. Dalton Jeffries would not be a high priority for me. I think you could do better on the college pitching side just because of the questions surrounding his health.
You know, obviously, as we get closer and closer to the draft, there are some guys that appear to have some late helium. You know, this happens every year. You know, who are a couple of guys for you that are really improving their stock over the last, you know, maybe 2 to 3 weeks people even who pay close attention to the draft might not be fully familiar with yet?
Yeah, I'd say there's probably three guys who fit that bill for me. Who, you know, Matt Manning was one, but I think it's been a little bit more than recent, and I think he's kind of firmly ensconced. But three guys who, if we were redoing our rankings again, we would definitely move up, and I think they're all going to go well in the first round. I guess in the order, I think they'll probably get drafted. First would be Justin Dunn from Boston College. Opened the season in the bullpen, moved to the rotation, showed people he could start. He might go very close to the top 10 now. I like him. I'm not sure. I think he's the second best college pitcher in this draft, but guys are pretty interested. I even had somebody, not a comp, but kind of parallel him to Dylan Tate. You know, it's kind of that situation where you know, you looked at as a reliever, then people realize you can start, and he's pretty athletic, and then they like the stuff. So guys are excited about him. It's a terrible, terrible draft for shortstops. And Delvin Perez, who we touched on earlier, is clearly number one. And Gavin Lux from Wisconsin, of all places, is actually the second best one. And, you know, he's just gotten, you know, stronger, faster, throwing better, swing better. Just he's improved across the board this year. And I think he kind of came into the year, and people were wondering a little bit, could this guy be an offensive second baseman? And I think now everybody thinks he's going to stay at short, and they like the offensive potential. And I think it's interesting with him. I think he definitely goes in the 20s, but I know, like, for instance, the White Sox like him, and I don't know if they can get him at 26. I don't know if they take him at 10, but if he went at 10, you know, if they're bored, you know, he's going to be pretty high up their board, I think, and I don't think it's out of the question that Gavin Lux could go 10. And then the third guy, and I think, you know, he could go, conceivably, and I'm not saying this will happen, you could see Lux go 10, Dunn go 11, and Zach Birdie go 12. You know, Birdie probably goes more in the 20s, but, you know, he's a guy, he's going to be the first relief pitcher taken. And what's nice about him, brother Nick Birdie, who was a second-round pick a couple years ago by Twins, is you could probably start Zach Birdie if you want. He's hit 101 with his fastball. His slider's improved. He actually has a changeup. He's got better delivery, better control than his brother. So you might be tempted. You could kind of Brandon Finnegan, Chris Sale him, rush him to the big leagues this year as some relief help for a contending team. And then you could decide next year, do we want to keep him in the bullpen or maybe put him in the rotation? But I think those three guys are probably, right now, a week before the draft, the guys who are shooting up, you know, where we think they're going to fit in that first round more than anybody right now.
Great. Last question for you. Who are some of your personal favorite prospects in this draft class? Whether it's guys you think might go in some of the, you know, later rounds in the early days, who you think could be, you know, big league contributors, or players who you think are just sort of underrated nationally in general.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess in terms of guys that you wouldn't necessarily, you know, project as lock first rounders, I think Carter Kieboom from Georgia has got one of the best high school bats in the draft, and his tools across the board, I mean, they're not wow, but they're pretty solid. I mean, they're not weak. I think he can have average power and play good third base. Kind of intrigued by Sheldon Noisy at Oklahoma. Had a very nice year for the Sooners. Probably moves from shortstop to third, but I think you could have some power and average there. He's probably more of a second-round pick. Ben Rortfit from another high school kid from Wisconsin, probably one of the better offensive catchers in this draft. So he's a guy who interests me. Those are three just off the top of my head that jumped to mind. You know, I'll tell you a guy who's interested for fantasy purposes. Right now, Jameson Fisher is leading Division I in hitting at .437 out of southeastern Louisiana, and I do think the bat's legit. I mean, he's going to be a first-base only guy. Missed last year with labrum surgery, but before that, he'd hit. He was drafted out of high school. I mean, this guy can hit. So in terms of fantasy sleeper, he might be a good guy to keep an eye on.
Again, thank you so much for joining us. This was great. I think our listeners will absolutely have learned a lot here. Is there anything in particular you want to plug while you're on here?
I guess I'd just say, you know, we'll have all kinds of coverage, more mock drafts coming. I had another one come out today at MLBpipeline.com. You know, all the content's free, all the scouting reports and video and features, all that stuff's free, so that's nice. And then next week I'll be part of the broadcast day one on MLB Network and MLB.com. And then day two, we have the exclusive broadcast of rounds 3 through 10 on MLB.com. And day three, I'll be hanging around the MLB.com studio in case we need to fill time if the conference call goes down during rounds 11 through 40. So I'll be pretty busy the next few days.
I have no doubt. So, yep, follow all of Jim's stuff at MLB Pipeline. Follow him on Twitter at Jim Callis MLB. And, Jim, thank you so much.
Yeah, no problem. Glad to help you guys.
All right. We'll talk to you soon.
Welcome back to episode 71 of Tino. As always, we'll send you out with a little housekeeping. You can follow us on Twitter at Tino Podcast and get in touch with us through email at tinopodcast@gmail.com. You can find Brett on Twitter at Dynasty Guru. You can find Craig at CD. That's CD as in
Cavs don't have a chance.
Very nice. Goldstein. You can find me at Ben Parsley. Thank you for listening and have a good night.
like phone a friend on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
Hey, this is Brett. I'm not here right now.
Damn it, Brett.
I'll call you back. Thanks. Bye.
Damn it, Brett.